Hi, Dan.
Hello, Jason.
Welcome back to the MacBook Aircast, a podcast entirely about the late 2020 M1 MacBook Air. I'm Jason Snell, owner of a late 2020 M1 MacBook Air, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, owner of a 2020 MacBook Air M1, Dan M1 Oren. Hello.
I changed my name for just this show.
How's it going?
Busy week. Going well. I have a MacBook Air, as you do. Mm-hmm. You have used other computers in the interim, though. That mainly like you've had review units, bunches of other computers.
I have used other computers. I've not been faithful to my MacBook Air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So,
this is my MacBook Air, which I think is maybe exactly the same model as yours, my old MacBook Air, is the one I brought from IDG. And yeah.
I think essentially the best MacBook Air when we left.
Right, Mac which World. Was the i7 build to order, top of the line, you know, whatever that was, early 2013, 2014, early 2014, I guess. So I haven't had a laptop of my own to replace that, mostly because I've been doing most of the stuff on the iPad and all of that. And every now and then I pull the MacBook Air out and it's old and many versions back and slow, but it is the laptop I need if I have a laptop until this week. So even though I don't use it a lot, it was still my laptop until I migrated on like Wednesday.
Yeah. Yeah, so I was using, as we've discussed many times before, I was using my 2014 MacBook Air, which was actually running Big Sur, with some interesting complications. And I'd really inured myself to it, even though I would use my iPad for some stuff sometimes, and of course I use my iMac mostly for work. But I had kind of, you know, embraced the downsides of that computer just because I was used to using them. And so I really ended up, kind of switching, just the hard cut there, right? Where I like put down the MacBook Air and picked up the new MacBook Air. Yeah. And it's not, you know, obviously the big thing a lot of people are talking about is the M1 stuff. But for me, a user of a 6-year-old MacBook Air, it is like night and day, because not only have I got a larger computer now, which I'm a little sad about, as we discussed last week, I think I really love the form factor of the 11-inch. But the Retina display and the fact that it's so much bigger, the new keyboard, which I really like, actually, I have been using that, you know, for the last several days pretty constantly. And I was fine with the keyboard on that old 2014 MacBook Air. It was fine. It was, you know, what there was at the time. I skipped the whole butterfly keyboard.
Yep.
Foo-fura.
Jump right over that.
But I got that new keyboard. I got Touch ID, which I'm kind of loving. USB-C ports for the first time on a laptop that I own. a lot has changed. and the M1 on top of all of that, which is, frankly, again, performance-wise, it just cooks. I mean, I was editing a podcast and I did the whole edit on my iMac, and then I dropped the Logic file on my MacBook Air just to export it and see how fast it was. And readers, it was fast. It was very, very fast.
Yeah. Yeah, I did do a test of the reason that I bought my iMac Pro, which is Isotope, the audio filtering software, pulling out noise in Noisy. I have so many people come to me now, and they're like, Jason, I need you to help me with this file. You've done that
come
occasionally.
Come to me on the day of their podcast.
Yeah, that's
ask for a favor.
That's right. All I ask in return is that one day I'll come to you and say, I must be a guest on your podcast. Isotope, which is an expensive piece of software, Isotope RX 8, I think it is now. It's got a great denoiser. It's got a de-reverb feature that's kind of like magic. Great stuff. But the noise remover is a multi-threaded operation. Some of their operations are not, and it's frustrating. And so it uses all the cores of my 8-core iMac Pro that they don't even sell anymore. And I am happy, to report that my iMac Pro is faster at that than the MacBook is.
by... I assume that's a it's running in emulation.
Yeah, that's yeah. As soon as Isotope does an update that has Apple Silicon, it will blow past it. I'm pretty sure. But that's one of those places where right now it's got the advantage. But you know that's part of the profile of these M1 computers is that their individual cores are very fast. So any operation that is running on essentially one core is gonna blow the competition away. It's the fastest Mac by that. But then if you spread it out across multiple cores and you've got those Xeons that have those powerful multiple core iMac Pros and Mac Pros, those are still faster, but that's what it takes. And then in this case of my little 8-core iMac Pro, I think probably native code will push it over the top for that test. So anyway, what I'm saying is I'm not going to replace my iMac Pro with an external monitor and a MacBook Air yet, but it's a close thing, which is just... On one level, that's sad. On another level, it excites me for whatever I will replace this iMac Pro with, that it will be spectacularly better at stuff than the iMac Pro is, which, I mean, it's only a three-year-old computer now, but I did spend $5,000 on it.
Sure, right. Yeah, that's the sobering thing, is the price tag associated with the performance.
And,
right?
and like that $699 Mac Mini is faster at a lot of things than the three-year-old $5,000 computer. Yep.
Yep. Well, that's the new world that we're living in. It is going to be a stark difference for a little bit as we make that adjustment. I have to say that, you know, what's interesting too, and this is not really an M1 thing or here or there, but you and I took like totally 180 degree opposite approaches to moving over to our MacBooks, which I enjoyed. I enjoyed that there is, a difference there, because in the past, when I've transitioned over, I have done the migration assistant, or I have done restoring from a Time Machine backup, or I've even just like cloned, like using like Super Duper essentially, and just been like whoop, you know, drop the image right down on the computer. And this time, because that 2014 MacBook Air had been migrated from a 2011 MacBook Air, which had been migrated from a 2008 MacBook, which had probably been migrated from a 2005 MacBook, I felt like, you know, there's some wonkiness every once in a while. There's stuff that I've done, like I have installed kernel extensions, or I've installed like stuff in the command line that I've then, you know, forgotten about years later. Or I've installed a ton of apps that I, you know, installed once and never used again.
Right.
And I could go through and clean all those out. But you know what? This seemed to me like a good time for me to do like a clean break and just start over, especially because for me, my MacBook Air, I don't keep files on it mostly anymore. Almost everything's in the cloud or on my NAS or something like that. So I don't actually have a lot of files to move. It's mainly like logging into stuff, downloading a handful of apps, and just, you know, setting up all my preferences. And so I spent most of Tuesday going through and like comparing my preferences. And in a couple cases, I like doing this because it gave me a chance to rethink certain assumptions about like things that I had set up, like, oh, I wonder why I set this preference this way, or even finding things that I didn't remember was like, oh, I didn't realize that was a preference you could set, because they've happened along the way and I've just glossed over them, for example. So it gave me a chance to sort of take a fresh look at the whole setup that I have going, and I've been pretty pleased with that experience so far. The one thing I have left to do is almost like 90% of the files on my old MacBook Air are in my downloads folder, because I am one of those people who just downloads stuff and then never goes through their download folder. Oh. So I've got like easily several gigs of stuff in my download folder that is like either stuff that can just get deleted or just needs to be filed away somewhere. It just has never happened. So that's like the last part of the process for me, is like sorting through what in there needs to be like archived someplace and what in there is just like trash.
I have some amazing things because I migrated, and I did. Migration Assistant did a good job. I like it. I keep doing it. It does, though, keep around all of the stuff that was there before.
Yeah.
And there's some...
Which is good. You don't want to lose anything.
There's just some amazing stuff. Some amazing stuff in there. So, like, I have been deleting apps that I find that are, you know, they're old 32-bit apps and they're ancient and all that. And it's just amazing because these are apps that I needed at some point. And still, like, even though I've deleted a bunch, I'm still finding, I just sorted the applications folder by time, and it's got like a Photoshop CS5, Let's see what else is in here. Everpix.
Oh yeah.
Firefox build from 2013.
Yeah, that's doing you a lot of good there.
Adium.
Yeah, I had Adium on some of mine.
Just Silverlight.
It's like, yeah. I like that it's, what you do is you sort it by date, and then it's like archaeological strata as you like unearth each layer. Ah, the Roman ruins.
Yeah, there's some really amazing ancient stuff in here.
It is interesting to do the fresh install and see what are the apps that I actually use, like on it, like because you immediately hit that where it's like, oh, I'm gonna go do this thing, and you're like, oh, I don't have that app installed. And there were a few things. There's definitely the one that I installed that I knew I had to install, but I wasn't looking forward to, was actually Dropbox of all things, just because I think their app has gotten worse over the years. But I still use it for enough stuff that I keep it around. And then this morning I was doing image editing and I was like, oh, I don't have Acorn installed, which is sort of my go-to image editor. So I need to grab that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's kind of, it's interesting to see how much stuff I get by with now that is, I was thinking like, oh, I'll just, you know, I mainly use built-in stuff most days. You know, I use Messages and Safari and Mail and Pages and, you know, that kind of jazz. And then I was like, oh, wait, I actually still use many, 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 many third-party apps, including many that are not things that I've gotten from the App Store. And so going through and installing all those
yep.
was a lot of fun to dig up my licenses and all that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, you're moving house, which you're also doing. So
I know.
You're doing it in computer form and in life form. But this is, it's I found it reassuring that when I got to the end of it, like, it was the old Mac, right? Like, it had the same wallpaper. Yeah. And I knew it was out of date because I hadn't been really taking care of it, like, because I haven't been using it regularly. It's sort of very, very
sporadic.
Got to get
your oil changed. Got to get your USB ports rotated.
Yeah,
got to
do all that stuff. And I haven't been doing it, so I had to get it caught up a little bit. But it was still reassuring. Also, the effect that I found was funny was I had this beautiful space backdrop image.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not Retina resolution. And so I did, the wallpaper was reassuring, and then I changed it because I wanted a higher resolution image than and that one didn't cut it anymore, which is what happened when I went to the iMac, right? It was like, I need 5K imagery now.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually using the one of the Big Sur wallpapers, the ones that are kind of like the sketchy ones, that like the artwork drawn ones. That adjust, so I think it's like a drawing of stuff from, I assume, Big Sur, but it has the dynamic thing where it changes during times of the day. I really like it. I think it's kind of a cool, different vibe from the stuff that we've seen in recent years, where it's all been, you know, beautiful photography, but like photography as opposed to artwork. And I honestly, just looking now, is like, oh, I guess I'm using the Catalina wallpaper on my iMac. Man, I used to be a custom wallpaper all the way person, and all of a sudden I feel like I've just started using the Apple wallpaper. Weird.
Yeah, what's wrong with you? What happened to the Dan Wiener?
I don't know. I think for a long time I didn't. The pictures I have, like you were just saying, the pictures I used to have as all my desktop patterns were always things I had taken. But now the pictures that I love that I've taken are so old that they are really tiny resolution. So you can't really do anything. I could tile them, I guess. Which would look really bad.
I copied over a bunch of images from my desktop pictures folder on my iMac, because that's the part of the unification here too, is that you know, I was thinking maybe I should have migrated from my iMac so that my, you know, MacBook Air was kind of a clone of my iMac, but instead I just kept it. In fact, I think my iMac is a migration from my 5K iMac, which was itself, I think, a migration from the MacBook Air. So they're both kind of, because that was my main computer. So they're both kind of branches of the same legacy. What I'm saying is both of my computers that are modern have preference files from 2008, probably somewhere, because I just keep migrating them. But I decided to go from the laptop since I figured, I don't know why, that's the legacy of, that's my laptop. Let's keep it as recognizably my laptop plus my SSD isn't big enough for all the contents of the iMac anyway. But it is funny because then I find myself copying things from my iMac back to the laptop where it's like, oh, BitBar isn't on there. I'm going to put BitBar on there and stuff like that. So it's getting there. You know, it's a big leap. I know it is for you, especially because, you know, you've been waiting for this for so long. And and I think, you know, the funny thing is, this is people who really care about computers and stuff have different needs from everybody else. But I think that, you know, for most people, the bottom line is they're fast, they have long battery life, they work really well, and there are seemingly no major compatibility issues. You know, the compatibility issues that exist are very specific, and I think the people who have those needs, you know it. But, you know, emulation, running Windows, homebrew, stuff like that is not there yet. But, you know, Rosetta covers up a lot of transition issues. Even my, I don't think I mentioned it here because I had them last week when we were talking, but I couldn't admit it. I have some command line stuff that I use that's pre-compiled binaries, and I just Intel binaries, and I just copy them over, and they run using Rosetta. It's not, yes, they take a performance hit, but they run. And
yeah, but that, as we've seen, stuff running under Rosetta still faster,
still
a lot of times.
Still really fast. So and that'll go away, right? All that stuff is almost certainly going to get recompiled. Everything is getting recompiled. The Apple II emulator that I use was recompiled for Apple Silicon the other week. So, like, everything. There was a story that somebody linked to. I was going around Twitter that was like, oh, I'm worried about this transition because it means incompatibility and, you know, you're not running old OSs and stuff. And it's like, come on. The emulators always get updated. Like, the emulators always get updated. They're getting updated now. Like, it will be fine. We'll go through a period where you will need an older computer to emulate older stuff, but then the emulators will get updated and then it'll be solved. So, like, the march of time. You know,
we already saw the thing, I think they were saying they got the people who make the app Crossover, right, which is sort of a packaged version of Wine.
Yeah.
The window emulator already had stuff running. And I think, you know, that is the thing that comes back to us talking about virtualization, which... Yeah, like a lot of those apps aren't there yet, but there's no reason that you can't run Windows in emulation on these. It's just going to be slower because you have to emulate the entire processor architecture as opposed to the virtualization that we saw on the Intel Macs, which, you know, because it was running on the same processor architecture, did not take as much of a hit there. But again, some of that gets compensated for. If you're trying to, gaming is never a good solution in emulation. It's never been good.
Right.
Like, if you're doing anything that requires like fast reaction and like just really intensive processor stuff, that didn't run great in virtualization, even on Intel Macs. Yes, you could boot into Windows,
yeah,
and that's the major
gone.
Advantage, right? Like, that's gone. That's the one thing I think that is just like, well, that's short of them coming to some agreement with Microsoft about the ARM version of Windows and the ARM version of Windows probably getting better. That's, you know, not happening anytime soon.
I am, to use the Tim Cook term, bullish about Windows on Apple Silicon.
I think it'll happen.
Yeah, I think that Apple isn't talking about it, but that doesn't mean it's not going to be there. I think Apple and Microsoft, first off, Apple and Microsoft are not enemies, right? They're partners about all this stuff. I think Microsoft sees it as an opportunity for more places for Windows, and Apple knows some of their customers care about Windows. And like, first off, Windows on ARM is so new that I think maybe it's in the plan. But like, I was reading the other day how they just came up with a way to run 32-bit apps in emulation or 64 bits in emulation where they were previously only do, like, they're still, Microsoft is still struggling with some of the things that Apple is not by moving to ARM, mostly because Apple kind of like cut compatibility off in Catalina,
right?
Like,
and that's what Windows does. It maintains compatibility,
right?
That's kind of their bread and butter.
But I feel like first off, Microsoft is pushing ARM Windows forward because this is complicated, right? I'm going to take a step back. The Verge posted a review of the new Dell XPS 13 2-in-1, which is, you know, Windows laptop that you can flip the screen around and treat it like a tablet. And it's a very popular laptop. And it was, I think, Charles Arthur, the British journalist, tweeted it and said, well, here we go. Because as of today, basically, this week, all of those PC laptops articles end with, you know, or you could use a MacBook Air, which is cheaper and way faster. And I thought about that, and I thought, you know, the advantage of being a PC maker is you don't have to do chip development because you've got your chip suppliers, and they're pushing it forward, and there's a level playing field, and everybody's going to get their chips. And you differentiate elsewhere. And now Apple is using Apple's chips, and Intel's chips, and you know, they don't measure up. They don't measure up. That's why Apple switched. And I look at that and I think, is any product going to drive ARM Windows devices more than M1 Macs? Like, if you're a PC maker, do you look at what Apple's doing and think to yourself, oh exactly. my God, we've got, like, let's, I mean, and I know there are ARM PCs now, but what I'm saying is, I feel like you look at this and it's like a real break where people are going to be more motivated, and that means Microsoft and PC makers, to embrace ARM processors, you know, you embrace Qualcomm. Qualcomm seems to have done a better job than Intel in terms of chip design over the last few years. It's an opportunity for Qualcomm to sell more chips and to do something that's more, you know, PC caliber chips. They, again, may be behind Apple, but it doesn't mean that they're necessarily behind Intel for certain uses. Yeah. It's just, it's fascinating. But I look at that and I think, well, of course, Microsoft wants Windows version of ARM to be decent. And I think it will take very little for Microsoft and Apple to get on the same page about virtualization of ARM Windows inside a Mac. It may be a harder thing to consider something like Boot Camp because, you know, Apple's hardware is its custom hardware.
And it's locked down.
Right. That's... But even then, you know, some people don't know, but like any Mac with a T2 chip has all that boot security stuff.
Right. True.
The boot security requires a signed operating system to boot. Microsoft Windows is supported, like it's part of Apple's security regime. Is it's macOS or Windows, so like they're already down the road there, and I think that if it technically makes sense, they will do it. But on the virtualization side, I think it's far more likely to happen pretty quickly, because like this is not just where Apple's going, it is kind of where the world is going. And
and that's the thing too, is if you're Intel or you're an Intel competitor, as you're just talking about, or you're Microsoft looking at Intel and thinking like, wow, do we really want our, you know, the entire future of our operating system tied to this architecture? Mm-hmm. You're probably thinking hard about that right now, because, you know, when you watch Apple and see that they are basically stepping away and they are taking a huge performance gain as part of that, you start thinking about, well, maybe we could do better, right? And I think Intel, this is a sort of a long road for Intel, but let's not forget that this move away from Intel for Apple is a significant blow to Intel, right? It's still making plenty of chips out there, but Apple was a big customer. Like, it's not like a, you know, it is a significant part of sort of the deals they're making. And again, it's Macs. It's not like they were buying, you know, their iPhone processors, right? Which would be an order of magnitude more, but it's still a lot of computers. And I feel like what's interesting about this is that it definitely continues to open up that PC market in terms of the players, right? Because not only is AMD stand to definitely make up some ground there, I feel like, because it's sort of always been in this war with Intel, but Intel has been indisputably the heavyweight.
We have always been at war with Intel.
We've always been at war with Intel. But all those companies like Qualcomm and other, doesn't NVIDIA make ARM chips too? I mean, like all of these other players, there's a lot more room there, especially if Windows decides to like kind of reduce its favored nation status for Intel a bit and like open the playing field more by saying, well, you know, Windows runs great on any processor that comes along, right? You know, I think there's a sea change happening, and you know, there has been, I think, to a large extent since Intel kind of seeded the mobile market, because that turned out to look, that was something that looked like this small niche market, I think. And then it turned into kind of the dominant market, and it's never going back, right? Like we're not ever going to say our smartphones, you know, who cares about our smartphones? Let's move back to giant computers that are tethered to our desks for like 90% of what we do, right? It's probably not happening. Mm-hmm. So stuff is going to keep changing. And I think Intel is, you know, they will survive, I think, but they are potentially vulnerable there in a way that they were not in the 90s and early 2000s.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see, but I think that, you know, to get back to the M1 Max, it'll shake out. Like, it is still early days. I think the big story is that unless you're somebody who cares about these very specific issues, they're fine. I was talking to a friend who was very reluctant to buy, you know, never buy first generation hardware, blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, yeah, I bought one. It's like, yeah, you did. You did buy one, because for most people, it's just not. It's not even visible. That's the beauty of this transition.
Yeah, I've noticed literally, I'm trying to think if I've seen a single thing. The one problem I ran into, and I think I mentioned this in the member Slack, was when I first installing apps, I tried to run a Rosetta app, and I think the dialog box either came up hidden or got dismissed, and then I could not get the dialog box to install Rosetta to come up again. Like, I would click on an Intel or Universal or Intel app, I guess, and it would just, nothing would happen. It just wouldn't launch. Nothing would appear in the dock. It wouldn't even like open and then go away. Like, just nothing would happen. And I was like, this is weird. And then it finally sort of clicked, like, oh, I must have accidentally like dismissed that, or something's not triggering right. So I had to restart, and then it would let me install Rosetta when I tried to. So I don't know why, just a bug or something. But other than that, and that was, you know, a very quickly fixed problem, I have not seen anything that has not run just fine. I haven't delved too much into some of the command line tools that I use, but probably as soon as there is a Apple Silicon version of Homebrew, I will probably install that. But it's not pressing enough for me on that computer that I need to even install the Intel version right now.
Yeah.
It's great.
It works, right?
And it works incredibly well. It's just such a nice computer. So gorgeous, so beautiful. Mm-hmm. I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, it is what we thought it would be. And the gotchas really aren't there. The iOS apps don't work right. Like, they're weird.
Yeah, I've only found, like you, I mean, I've sort of been scanning the store and downloading things here and there, and testing a few things, and I totally agree with you. Most stuff is pretty garbagey, and it's kind of, I'm fascinated to see kind of what the end game of that is, right? Because there are a couple approaches I can imagine. One is from the Apple side, where if Apple does say eventually, you know what, we're adding some touch interfaces for some Macs that we're making. You know, these might be new design Macs, they might be laptops, unclear, and that will accommodate, you know, apps that you run that are iOS apps. It could happen. I think the other option is a lot of these developers saying, wow, our apps really run like garbage on the Mac. Maybe we take the, you know, little bit of time to make them at least sort of the bare minimum of good citizens on the Mac, and that's it. Or I guess the other alternative is they just be like, no, we're never letting our iOS apps run on the Mac. But I don't know. Yeah. That seems like a weird choice, because I was talking to James Thompson a little bit about this, and I feel like the kind of, like, that's kind of where Mac Catalyst, it seems like, kind of comes into the picture, right? Is like, not to say Mac Catalyst apps are great either, but they're kind of better than iOS apps just running native on the Mac. So maybe that's kind of the pathway, is like, hey, spend this little bit of time investing in you know, improving these apps a little bit, and you've opened yourself up to a new platform or something. But I don't know. It's a weird proposition for iOS developers too, right? Because the argument there is, well, I'm opening myself up to a new platform, but people have already bought my app. I'm not getting anything extra out of this other than people, new customers might be like, oh, it's great that it works on both platforms. But I can see the argument to wanting to not have apps that you just buy once and run everywhere, because certainly could cost them some money.
Yeah, I mean, in the long run, yeah, if your business model is buy separately on both platforms, then yeah, you're going to do that. And other people have the business model of they want everybody to get it everywhere. That's the thing we're going to have to watch, because it may be nothing. Like, the iOS apps on the Mac may turn out to be nothing or almost nothing, like games and nothing else. Or it may be a lever that Apple uses to get developers to add Catalyst, right? It's like, oh, we don't like it. It's not quite good enough. And they're like, well, I have a solution there. Add the Catalyst stuff in, and then it'll be good enough. And then it won't be an iOS app anymore. It'll be a Mac app. And that that might be a sales pitch that they could go down. I think, I don't know. It's a weird thing. I do think that maybe the solution is that if there's another class of Mac that comes out that is a full-on touchscreen,
yeah,
that
there's better argument there,
right? And you might even have the situation where they're visible on touchscreen Macs, right, and not on non-touchscreen modes, and that really is just there because you can run them and it thinks it's an iPhone or it's an iPad.
The thing I get annoyed with is the apps where there is no, like, their Mac, quote-unquote Mac app is like literally a web app on their website, right, where it feels like I'm thinking of like something like AnyList. Like, I don't believe there's a Mac app for AnyList, and it's something that I use for my shopping list. And it's like, well, you can go to the web, but I don't like their web interface. I don't want to use their web interface.
There is a Mac app for AnyList.
Oh, is there? Okay, yeah. It's not in the store, is it? I take it all back.
I don't know.
I regret.
I don't think it is in the store, but I do have it.
Maybe that's why you
got to be a paying customer to use it. Otherwise, you have to use their web interface.
Oh,
but I pay them.
That's why
I pay them.
All right. Well, then that's why they didn't let me have the Mac app.
You got to not be a cheapskate, Dan.
You know what? I use like 3 features. That's fine.
I know, but I gave them money because it's our shopping list. So I thought, okay, I'll give you money.
Yeah. There are, I think, other cases where there are apps where it's like you don't have a Mac app, you have an iOS app, and it seems like the Mac app would be, you know, putting the iOS app on the Mac would at least help. And then there's other things where you mentioned games, and I think games are interesting too, because a lot of the games, I've tried a few, they really don't play very well in my experience. Like, I tried using Among Us, and that game does not play very well on the Mac. You have to use the alternate like touch interface where it's just clicking, but it's one of those frustrating things. I talked about this in the Rebound this week. The PC version of it has like keyboard shortcuts and stuff that you can run, but because the iOS version doesn't support the keyboard, it's basically like the default interface is like one of those little virtual joysticks, and it's like,
yeah,
using that on the Mac is garbage. It's really
bad.
No, and
there's supposed to be that like touch accommodations, touch interface thing.
Weird,
where you're supposed to be able to basically map part of your trackpad to be the joystick.
I tried Pocket Run Pool with that, and I was like, this is odd. Yeah. It feels strange. It's not designed for this very clearly.
No, and then again, this would be solved if they had a touch screen, right? Because you could just say, oh, well, this is an iOS app. You got to touch it. Like that. Just simple. I don't know. It's weird, but it's there. Like, you don't have to use it. I mean, that's the beauty of it, is you don't have to use it. And if you have a use case, then great. But I'm disappointed that a bunch of apps that would, I think, make the Mac better are not there. And so the Major League Baseball app is the one that I would point out as a great example, because they have a web interface to watch like baseball games in season. They have a web interface. It's not great. And the thing I never like about the web interface is that now my browser has a window that's playing the baseball game. And like, if I do something with my browser, it gets messed up. It puts a tab inside the video window, or the next window I make is the wrong size, or like, I don't want stuff in my browser that's a separate thing, right? And I've used, like, there's challenges using like a single site browser. Sometimes they don't work quite right with the video apps. But anyway, the MLB app on Apple Silicon, the iOS app, it runs. You can full screen it. You don't have to full screen it. And it'll even do picture in picture, and it works. And that's what all the video services should do, because it's nice to have an app instead of having to use their website. Plus, you can download, if you're just using a laptop, you can download a movie and watch it on the plane, theoretically, right? Using Netflix, if it was there, but Netflix isn't there. HBO Max is there, and it won't let you full screen, and it doesn't support picture-in-picture, so it's stupid. So this is there's something right there, and I know it will work because the MLB app works right, but the fact that HBO Max got highlighted by Apple, as an example, is really telling, because it's terrible. And this is why Apple didn't do an expansive promotion of iOS apps running on the Mac, because and at the time I was like, why aren't they not showing that to us? And then I used it and I thought, oh, it's because it's not very good.
It's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that will be interesting for sure. I'm fascinated to see how that develops. It's not as big a deal as I had hoped it would be, you know, just because of the fact that so much stuff has already gotten pulled. But, you know, who knows? Maybe it opens up some doors. I want one to mention, because a big week and a lot of other stuff happened, but the surprise announcement from Apple that it would allow some developers to cut their commission rate from 30% to 15% if they make less than $1 million worth of revenue, basically, after Apple takes its commission, has, that engendered some conversation. And it kind of funny, because it feels like it must be tough to make an argument that Apple taking less money is a bad thing, but some people made some really game tries at it. Mostly people who are already mad at Apple, because, you know, that's
sure.
Saw some hot takes that were pretty bad.
Yeah. The sort of dispassionate way to look at it is Apple made this change because it doesn't cost them a lot of money. It makes them look good and generous. It is happening because they're under assault for their practices, and they're trying to find ways to defuse that and deflect that, and that the people who are out to get them, because they are on the other side of a political issue, which is Apple's control of its platform versus free access to its platform by those who wish to have access to it, this is a good move politically for Apple, and so Apple's opponents are mad, right? And they're trying to counter it, because I think there's a tone in some of the people's comments, and these are the people you'd know. It's the guy from Epic Games, and it's the guy from Basecamp, who've been very public about this. Like, their tone. They're doing what they should do, right? Which is react to their opponent making a move against them. But because they come across as so self-righteous, I would say, and like such a they're the heroes, they're the underdogs. I feel like it's a challenge for them, because, and this is why it's such a jujitsu kind of, it's a good move for Apple. So of course they're upset about it, because it hurts their cause. It hurts their side of the case. Their opponent made a move, and it's a difficult move to counter. So of course they're making a lot of noise. But that shows you the issue is, like, it ends up being this case where Apple has isolated them and said, well, these are big businesses, and they're basically, put your big boy pants on, give us 30% and deal with it, because you're making a lot of money. And look at us, we're so generous to the smaller developers. And that's, you know, it's a good tactical move on Apple's part. And, like, make no mistake, that's what it is. It's a PR move. And yeah, those guys have a difficult job of navigating that. It's made their case a little more difficult, but that's why Apple did it. And did they think that Apple was not going to come for them? Right? Like, did they think that Apple was not going to counter their moves? Right? So I get it. And yeah, DHH looks, David Heinemeier Hansson looks super jerky in his Twitter thread, more than usual, I would say, because he's been put in a difficult spot where he has to kind of recontextualize what he's standing for. And, you know, he's not aided by the fact that he's throwing in things like, you know, it's all a conspiracy because there was an embargo. It's all a conspiracy, and journalists are part of the conspiracy. And it's like, no, dude, it was just an embargo. I don't know. I think it's a sign of somebody whose position has been dramatically weakened, and they're trying to bluster their way back to a new location from which they can you know, launch new attacks in the new state of affairs.
I mean, yes, I agree. It's just, it was comical almost, the degree of fulmination emanating from this with like,
oh yeah,
Apple is a evil Roman emperor who is making people battle for their whims, and you're sitting there going, what are you talking about?
So your DHH or Sweeney from
Tim
Epic.
Sweeney comparing it to civil rights movement. Why?
Well, so I think it's it caught them off guard, and they know that it hurts their argument, and they don't have a new argument yet. And so what you do while you don't have your new argument yet is you do a lot of evil. They're evil, everybody. This is the kind of thing an evildoer does. They do evil. This is evil. Don't listen to them while we figure out what we're going to say. Don't listen, right? Like that's kind of all you can do. And so that's what they did. I mean, I get it. Like, and I'm seriously, I have some opinions about this, but they're nuanced. Like, I see what they're saying. I get what Apple's doing.
Yeah.
If you take a step back, though, it's like Apple made a move here. It was a good move. Like Ben Thompson from Stratechery was talking about it, and he basically said, okay, he said two things. One, is this a PR gambit? Absolutely. Two, how'd it work? Pretty well. And that's like, I mean, you can know that it's a PR move, and that it's, as John Siracusa said, it's not like every developer doesn't like serve at the whim of Apple. Like Apple could take this back tomorrow. It's not, you know, anything other than Apple retaining control, but being a little more generous with the people that it controls. But that said, it's very hard to look at it knowing all of that and not say also every indie developer basically just got a 20% raise. Like, right. It's also true. And
there's still
it's
money
also
in people's
good PR.
Pockets.
Even if it's PR, and we know it's PR, it's good PR. That's how good it is we know it's PR and it still works.
Yep. And I mean, end of the day, there's still money in the pockets of people who didn't have that money before.
And in the banana stand.
Yeah. Oh, there's always money in the banana stand. And I think, you know, does this presage from a larger movement on Apple's part? I think that it will be interesting to see when they roll out the full details of this, which they promised next month, especially because there have been, I think, some valid criticisms about the like, well, maybe, you know, why not just reduce the commission on the first $1 million or something like that? And I think the answer is they want more money from the companies that are going to be constantly making more money. But, you know, there may be some rejiggering of this before it goes officially live.
Yeah,
we'll see.
They actually said more details will be released in December.
In December. Like yeah. So, but I think it's a good move. I mean, it doesn't negate a lot of the problems that these people actually have, right? I think that's the clever PR part, right? Like, it's, you know, Tim Sweeney's over there arguing about money, but a lot of people are arguing about control. And this doesn't change literally anything about Apple's control on their, like, what they will allow on their platform and what they won't allow on the platform. But now nobody's talking about that. All they're talking about is the money, and that's why it's a great PR move. And so I think it will be interesting to see, because the real question to me gets around to back, like, does this get Apple out of the crosshairs of the regulation? Because that is the biggest threat to them right now, is potentially the intervention of the government saying, well, we think your practices are anti-competitive. I don't think it changes much in the way of calculus there, other than to say, if the government and regulators are interested in that, there are much bigger fish to fry right now than Apple making too much money on its platform and not allowing, you know, Epic's game store.
I think from a political standpoint, and this has always been a weakness, and Apple knows it, and that's why Apple made this move that intensifies this weakness in their competition, is it's so easy to write this whole thing off as big companies squabbling over who gets more.
Yep.
And while that is important, and that there is a power imbalance between Apple and these other companies, it makes it seem like a lot less of a priority and a lot easier to brush off. If Apple can make this seem like this is really about Epic Games, an enormous company, just wanting to keep more money and not give it all to Apple, and Apple saying, well, no, they owe us money, and you're like the billionaires fighting over who wins the $1,000 bet. Like, who cares? Who cares? Right. And Apple wins in that scenario, because it's not a great political story to say, you know, we really need, what's really important is reform of the battles between billionaires, right? That, like that, And again, I'm not saying that there isn't real stuff going on here. I'm just saying perception-wise, the more Apple can make it seem like that, which they're doing a good job of right now, the harder it's going to be for anybody in any political sphere to care.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Yep.
That's where we're at.
All right. Well, who knows what will happen? I'm hoping nothing interesting will happen between now and next week. You're not going anywhere for Thanksgiving, right?
Nope. I'll be at home.
Yeah, me too. And I hope, honestly, I'm just going to say this to everybody out there. Stay home if you can.
Stay home.
Be safe. We're going to dial in our family members via Zoom and make a little dinner for ourselves. And that's just how it's going to be.
We may do a dish exchange with like my parents and like meet at a middle location and trade some casserole dishes or something like that.
Trade dishes at distance. That's fine. Yeah. That's good. A lot of virus out there. The Americans, it's Thanksgiving, it's American holiday. So people outside the U.S. aren't going through this. I mean, you may be going through a virus surge. We're going through a virus surge and we've got a holiday where lots of people travel. So just, you know, be safe. Stay home if you can. Batten down the hatches. We'll get through this. So, but we'll be back. Dan and I will be there to keep you company next week because we'll be back next Friday with more of this, whatever this is. The MacBook Air report will return.
I will say that probably later today, maybe we'll see. I will have a HomePod mini review too.
Oh.
So keep your eyes peeled for that.
All right. But until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.